Here it is!
From deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know what it's like where you are, but here it's zero defects. And we're going to keep it that way. I'm in London, so I don't think the NSA can hear my calls here.
Harry, I don't have to listen to your phone calls to know what you're doing.
Thank you, Joe Biden. And you are listening. That's sweet. Ratings are up. Joe Biden's listening. And ladies and gentlemen, and Joe, some news of the godly. Speaking of abuse, nuns used to batter boys during daily abuse at a children's home in Londonderry, Northern Ireland, one victim has claimed. John Haney was caned on the feet by members of the Order of the Sisters of Nazareth at St. Joseph's in Turnbull, and said he suffered sexual abuse from older boys. Nuns were very good at raising their hands. All the boys have a flat spot on the back of their heads because they were battered stupid, he says. They came in smart? Really? Turnbull will be one of the first residential homes examined with evidence witnesses due to begin coming weeks. Haney made his comments as he prepares to attend the hearings. Detectives are expected to be watching the public hearings closely. Haney said he hoped the perpetrators would ultimately face justice. Many have lobbied for a public inquiry in Northern Ireland for years, spurred on by the holding of similar probes down south in Ireland. Yes, they're two separate countries, ladies and gentlemen. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. And while we're wondering about the honeybees and the colony collapse disorder, which threatens the pollination of many of our more popular crops or cropular pops, there's the issue of the wild bees. The decline of wild bees and other pollinators may be an even more alarming threat to crop yields than the loss of honeybees, according to a worldwide study reported in the Guardian newspaper revealing the irreplaceable contribution of wild insects to global food production. Oh, there's one right there. Scientists studied the pollination of more than 40 crops in 600 fields across every populated continent, sorry, Antarctica, and found wild pollinators were twice as effective as honeybees in producing seeds and fruit on crops, including oilseed rape, got to change the name of that, coffee, onions, almonds, tomatoes, and strawberries. Further, trucking in managed honeybee hives did not replace wild pollination when wild pollination was lost, but only added to the pollination that took place. Quote, it was astonishing. The result was so consistent and clear, unquote, Lucas Garibaldi at the National University at Rio Negro, Argentina, who led the team. We know, he says, wild insects are declining, so we need to start focusing on them. Yeah, never too late. Without such changes, he says, the ongoing loss is destined to compromise agricultural yields worldwide. You better figure out how to start manufacturing food from scratch, ladies and gentlemen, don't you think? I mean, like in the lab, pollination is needed for about three-quarters of global food crops. The decline of honeybee colonies has prompted serious concern. Jason Tilianakis at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand described honeybees as the species charged with protecting global food security. Uh-oh. The new research shows for the first time the huge contribution of wild insects and shows honeybees cannot replace them as their habitat is destroyed. Garibaldi says relying on honeybees is a highly risky strategy because disease can sweep through a single species, and single species cannot adapt to environmental changes nearly as well as a group of wild pollinators. Man, I heard a group of them last night in the house next door. The studies show conclusively that biodiversity has a direct measurable value for food production and that a few managed species cannot compensate for the biodiversity on which we depend, says Tilianakis, who was not part of the research team. Global degradation of natural services, says Garibaldi's team. Global degradation of natural services can undermine the ability of agriculture to meet the demands of the growing human population. There is a scholar at Loyola University in New Orleans by the name of Rob Virchik, who wrote a book a couple years ago talking about how we have not yet learned to put a monetary value on the services that nature provides us, whether it's flood protection or, in this case, pollination. And so because we don't put a dollar value on it, we wave it goodbye. Garibaldi in the study says without wild pollination, you will not get the best yields and the best agricultural land already farmed. So it is very important to get the maximum yield. Wild pollinators perform better than honeybees because they deploy a wider range of pollinating techniques. Guys, take a tip, such as buzz pollination. Well, buzz pollination is drunk pollination. They also visit more plants, meaning much more effective cross-pollination than honeybees, who tend to carry pollen from one flower to another on the same plant. What is it with those guys? A second new study published in Science this week showed more than half the wild bee species were lost in the 20th century in the United States. Half of the 109 bee species had been lost between a survey in the late 1890s and now. And there had been a serious degradation of the pollination provided by the remaining wild insect, with their ability to pollinate specific plants falling by more than half. There's also an increasing mismatch between when plants flower and when bees were active, a finding consistent with climate change. The system is incredibly compromised, and further degradation will have serious impacts, said Laura Burkel at Washington University in Montana. Well, that's a little misplaced, don't you think? She led the team. So eat up, ladies and gentlemen, while you can. Hello, welcome to the show.
Você fez coração, mas sem cuidado. Vai, meu coração, pede perdão, perdão apaixonado. Vai. Te perdão, não é nunca perdoado.
From London, England, home of the English, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show, and now, news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersol Jr. Oh, we're getting so close, you can almost be afraid of it. Plagued by terrorism fears, controversy over gay rights, and broader political turmoil, the upcoming Winter Olympics in Sochi is forcing marketers who pour hundreds of millions of dollars into the games to perform a careful balancing act. On the beam? Or on the floor? On the ice? This is from Financial Times. The Olympics offer an unparalleled opportunity for major advertisers such as Coke, McDonald's, and General Electric to reach billions of viewers around the world. Oh, that's what it's for. And align themselves with a blend of feel-good emotions tied to the glory of the games. Yet potential security risks and human rights controversies in Russia, while likely to attract bigger audiences, are making this year's Winter Olympics a much riskier bet. Advertising spending during the games is expected to reach record levels this year, with the Olympics standing out as one of the few events where marketers can reach mass audiences. But security concerns loom large. Advertising next to coverage of a potential terrorist attack would be disastrous, and marketers likely would pull their ads, marketing executives say. Meanwhile, rows over human rights and gay rights are sparking concern, as many advertisers preach a commitment to freedom and diversity, say executives. What brands need to do is make sure they're able to stay with those qualities that make the Olympics so unique and so terrific, and not allow themselves to get sucked into the politicization of the games, says Robert Mathias, chief executive of Ogilvy Public Relations in America. The Sochi Winter Olympics are opening February 7th. It's starting to look as if many fans have decided to give them a miss, according to Business Week. Listings of tickets put up for resale on a fan-to-fan website have soared almost 50% over the past week. More than 3,100 offers now posted. Most include multiple tickets, up to a maximum 8 per offer. The U.S. website of CoSport, the exclusive ticket agent for North America and most of Western Europe, still lists seats available for some sought-after events, such as gold medal men's ice hockey. The Sochi website, the official sales outlet for residents of Russia and many other countries, has tickets available for more than 100 events. Availability is far greater than demand, says the secretary of the EU Secondary Ticketing Association. Some buyers may have changed their minds about going, she says, while others may have bet unsuccessfully that if they bought tickets early, they could resell them at a profit later when supplies ran low. Meanwhile, Human Rights Watch has published a guide to the Sochi Winter Olympics and Paralympics for journalists that outlines coverage risks and widespread human rights abuses that it says contradict the values in the Olympic Charter. It says while the Russian government clearly hopes to elevate the country's image, human rights abuses and controversies have plagued Olympic preparations, including a harsh crackdown on media and civil society. Says Human Rights Watch, preparations have been marred by the exploitation, illegal detention and deportation of migrant construction workers, as well as forced evictions of Sochi residents. But wait, there's more. Americans planning to attend the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia, should be vigilant about their security due to potential terrorist threats, crime, and uncertain medical care, according to the State Department. Our State Department. Well, the United States State Department. In a travel alert, the department said it was not aware of specific threats to U.S. interests related to the Games, but it said large events like the Olympics are an attractive target for terrorists, and Americans should be aware of their surroundings and take common sense precautions, notably on public transport. I wonder if the State Department had to explain to Americans what public transport is. Public transport in the general vicinity of Sochi has been targeted by terrorists as recently as late December, although the department stressed those attacks took place in a city some 600 miles away from the Games. The alert pointed out that Russia has vowed to take appropriate security measures to protect athletes, spectators, and infrastructure. The FBI is deploying at least a couple dozen people in Moscow and maybe a smaller number, but still a dozen or more people of different specialties in Sochi, according to FBI Director James Comey. In addition to the potential for terrorism, the State Department said Americans should consider buying private medical evacuation insurance if they attend the Olympics, because medical facilities are untested in Sochi, which has never before hosted such a large event. Or maybe the State Department is just flacking for insurance companies, like the rest of the... What? And if you were planning to join the 21st century and watch the Winter Olympics opening ceremony online, sorry. NBC won't let you. NBC will not offer a web stream of the Sochi opening ceremony. The network will stream every athletic competition, but the opening ceremony will be transmitted exclusively on this thing called television. NBC Sports Chairman Mark Lazarus told the press this week that the opening ceremony deserves to be presented in the grandest fashion possible. Translation, with the most commercials. Because, you know, there's Coke and McDonald's and General Electric. Said Lazarus, we want to put context to it. with the full pageantry it deserves. Oh, we missed the Cubans coming in because we were on a break. But look at this pageantry. Thanks to the State Department for suggesting we buy more insurance. The Olympics. It's a move. Say it with me now. It's a movement. And we all need one. Every day. Oh, I wish we had the rest of the music, but we had to take a break for a commercial. Ladies and gentlemen, news of the new F-bomb foreclosure coming your way here on the broadcast. The man who once ruled over Florida's massive foreclosure mill was disbarred this week by the Florida Supreme Court. This officially ended a decades-long legal career tarnished by accusations of fraud and misconduct in the whole foreclosure thing. The ruling came against David J. Stern, who built his law firm on repossessing homes. That's a firm foundation. The ruling was expected. He did not appeal a referee's recommendation for disbarment last October. Stern's attorney said he had no comment. The Supreme Court order gives Stern 30 days to close his practice. His company, what once handled more than 200,000 foreclosure cases just in the state of Florida, effectively already shut down 3 years ago after he lost most of his clients amid allegations of notary fraud, robo-signing, and shoddy legal work. Notary fraud in which non-notaries notarized stuff. Stern said he wasn't to blame for the problems at his firm. He said that during his October hearing, where the Florida bar pursued, 17 complaints against him. He characterized the findings as unintended mistakes. His refusal to accept responsibility was noted by Palm Beach Judge Nancy Perez, who acted as the referee in the case and recommended disbarment. Quote, Mr. Stern has not expressed any remorse in these proceedings, much like J.P. Morgan. He has taken no responsibility. Perez also scolded Stern for blaming his attorneys and paralegals for the flaws in foreclosure filings. The incidents were not isolated, but rather a representation of the culture of the firm as to the low level of confidence and competence and ethics, Perez wrote in her 35-page report. Stern is the lawyer. It was his firm. Stern is responsible. As Florida's foreclosure crisis grew, Stern built his firm by taking on mega bank clients. Oh, like J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. You've heard of them. And federal mortgage backers Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. His office, once 800 square feet, ballooned to 7 floors with 1,500 employees, including 150 attorneys, all of whom just happened to make the same mistakes over and over and over and over again. Goodbye, David. Not the NBA David Stern, who's retiring. This is the F-bomb David J. Stern. Dave, we hardly liked ye. Now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Well, I hope you don't like carnivores, because 3/4 of the world's big carnivores, including lions, wolves, and bears, are in decline, according to a new study. A majority now occupies less than half their former ranges, according to data published in Science. The loss of this habitat and prey and persecution by humans has created global hot spots of decline. I think those would be cold spots, but The researchers say the loss of these species would be extremely damaging for ecosystems the world over. The authors say that in the developed world, most carnivorous animals have already succumbed to extinction. They're right. I haven't seen a living lion in London since I got here. When they looked at 31 big meat eaters, see, if we didn't like them, they'd be flesh eaters. But they're meat eaters. They found that they were under increasing pressure in the Amazon, Southeast Asia, and Southern and East Africa. Globally, we are losing our large carnivores, said lead author Professor William Ripple from Oregon State University. Their ranges are collapsing. Many of these animals are at risk of extinction either locally or globally. The researchers say their work highlights the important ecological role of many of these carnivores. Having fewer wolves and cougars in Yellowstone, for example, resulted in an increase in animals that browse, such as elk and deer. Researchers found that the rise of the browsers is bad for vegetation and disrupts the lives of birds and small mammals, leading to a cascade of damaging impacts. Similar effects were seen all over the world. The rise of olive baboons in Africa has been linked to the decline of lions and leopards, but the baboons now pose a bigger threat to farm crops and livestock than elephants. They're meat eaters too, though. Some baboons. I don't know about the olive ones. Take it from me. The scientists say much of the problem comes from an old-fashioned notion that predators are harmful and just a threat to other wildlife. The authors say there needs to be a rapid recognition of the complex roles these carnivores play and how much they're worth in economic terms. Well, there you go again. Natural services, not valued. And when people try to replicate the services provided by these animals, they aren't as effective. Much like how good we are at rebuilding wetlands. Ask Florida. We say these animals have an intrinsic right to exist, but they're also providing economic and ecological services that people value, says Professor Ripple. Among the services of value that have been documented in other studies are carbon sequestration, biodiversity, and disease control. When large carnivores are reintroduced, like wolves and Yellowstone, the ecosystems tend to respond rapidly. It isn't happening quickly everywhere, says Ripple, but in some places, ecosystem restoration has started. The authors argue there needs to be an international initiative to conserve these larger carnivore species in a peaceful coexistence with humans. So, who's going to be the first movie star to adopt a wolf? I'm just asking. News of the Warm, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And we will get to news of our friend the Atom momentarily. It is coming up so very shortly. But first, this for your listening pleasure.
I guess I'm just lucky so-and-so.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, you may have joined me in marveling at the propensity of people to begin their interviewees on radio, television, to begin their answers with the word so. At least one interviewee is becoming sensitized, I think, to this problem. You're going to hear an interview with someone who thinks the word well or you know, traditional beginnings to sentences, should come before the use of the initial so, making it the secondary so. So sit back, relax, and listen to some answers that don't conclude with so, but they don't all begin with them either. And by the way, count the so's. That'll be fun for the whole family.
So how is the sagegrass population doing right now?
Sure. As we know, in March of 2010, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service identified the greater sage-grouse as warranted but precluded from listing on the U.S. Threatened and Endangered Species list.
How important is Oregon for sage-grouse?
Yeah, you know, so Oregon, we have about 10.2 million acres on BLM-administered lands.
So what are the pressures on it?
Yeah, so the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in their listing identified some of what they're calling the threats.
Why is grazing an issue for sage-grouse?
This was one of the issues that was identified in the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's finding.
Walk us through what this plan would mean.
Sure. So it's a draft environmental impact statement. So at this point, as you mentioned, we have six alternatives. So two of the alternatives were based on conservation input from citizen groups during our scoping process. And then the preferred alternative, which is the one you want me to focus on, correct?
Well, that's the one that you're recommending.
So, at this point, it's all draft. So we identify a preferred, but we are really – this is the public comment period, so no final decisions have been made.
By next year, they have to decide whether or not to list the sage-grouse as an endangered species.
Right. So that's – they are – while separate processes, there is a relation.
Have there been any particular comments that you know have already changed the BLM's plan for this preferred plan?
So we accepted written comments during those meetings. And so what happens is we actually wait until the close of the public comment period, which is on February 20th.
I guess if you say so, I'll have to pack my things and go.
That's right.
The word is so. Ladies and gentlemen, the word of the year. And the year has just begun.
The bump right on a swamp. Did it, why did it? Took it to the city. Mixed it up, turned it all around. From the boogie woogie country town. It did the fruit and two left shoes. That guy did in rhythm and blues. And it did it with so much soul that had to.
This is Lachaud from London, England, where we learned that a consultant to the British government on the subject of reducing sugar in the diet, part of a big obesity study, turns out, according to the Times of London today, owned by Rupert Murdoch, that he's on the payroll of Coca-Cola and Mars. But, nice to know exactly whom can be bought. Who? No whom. Now news of the atom.
Clean, safe, too cheap to meet. Save, safe, too cheap to meet. Cheap, save, too safe to meet. Save, safe, too safe to meet.
I say who?
Addie says who. Okay, Addie the Atom has checked in with his grammatical spin.
That's cute.
You feeling better this week?
Yeah, I was just spinning really slowly. It was so cold.
That would do it. That, of course, that is the definition of cold, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so.
A Japanese engineer who helped build part of the Fukudaiichi Reactor No. 4 said in Taiwan this week that the safety of nuclear power plants is unpredictable, urging Taiwan to ditch atomic energy for renewable resources. Mitsuhiko Tanaka,
having trouble with that?
Yes, who arrived in Taiwan with a delegation of Japanese parliamentarians, told a press conference that the Chernobyl meltdown in 1986 changed his views on nuclear power.
It's ancient history, babe.
Nuclear accidents are bound to happen someday, only we don't know when they will happen, he said. Tanaka, who helped build part of the No. 4 reactor at Fuk while working at Hitachi in the 70s.
Ancient history, babe.
Quit the company in 1977. He chronicled, as a writer, a manufacturing defect in the steel vessel installed at the No. 4 reactor and the subsequent cover-up in a book he published in 1990.
Recent history, babe.
He also went to Japan's Ministry of International Trade and Industry in 1980 to report the cover-up, but the government refused to investigate, and Hitachi denied his allegations.
And denounced the alligator?
I didn't say that. Nebraska's Fort Calhoun nuclear plant, recently returned to service after nearly 3 years offline to address regulatory concerns, was forced to shut down Thursday because of freezing conditions on the adjacent Missouri River. Remember way back last summer where they had to shut down nuclear plants because the cooling water was too hot? Now it's the other thing. A plant worker found a block of ice had formed on an intake structure sluice gate.
Another scandal?
No, it's just a gate. According to a report filed with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the gate could not be closed. As a result, technical specs required that the raw water pumps be declared inoperative, and the plant was manually shut down.
That is to say, once a year.
That's right. The other five sluice gates were not affected. Flooding was not anticipated, but all six gates must be able to close in case flood conditions develop, according to the power district. So they don't like it when the water's too warm. They don't like it when the water freezes. What's with these plants? Remarkable new figures from Spain's electric grid operator revealed that greenhouse gas emissions from that country's power sector are likely to have fallen more than 20% last year alone as power generation from wind farms and hydroelectric plants soared and, coincidentally, while the economy kind of tanked. Greenhouse gas emissions from Spain's power sector, according to the preliminary report on the country's power system, wind power actually contributed most to the annual electricity demand coverage. Wind turbines met 21% of electricity demand on the Spanish peninsula, narrowly beating the region's fleet of nuclear reactors, which provided 21%. But the wind provided 21.1.
That's niggling.
Can you say that?
I just did.
In total, wind farms are estimated to have generated almost 54,000 gigawatt hours of electricity, up 12% on the previous year. High levels of rainfall meant hydroelectric power output was 16% higher than the historical average. In contrast, the preliminary figures show that power output from gas plants fell 34%, coal-fired plants saw generation fall 27%, nuclear power output fell 8%.
Better than coal.
For the first time ever, wind power contributed most to the annual electricity demand coverage in Spain. The overall power demand fell 2% because of the economy. Nothing from you, right?
Yeah, I like wind.
Nuclear radiation at the Fuk power plant has reached 8 times above the acceptable government safety guidelines, according to reports of TEPCO. The levels of nuclear radiation around Fuk have risen to 8 millisieverts per year, surpassing the government standard of 1 millisievert. TEPCO officials told the press the main reason behind the drastic increase in radiation were X-rays coming from storage tanks holding radioactive water that has been leaking from Fuk.
So go and get your X-rays now. They're cheap.
The state nuclear regulator there held a meeting aimed at curbing the rising levels of radiation at the plant. Meetings do that, right? They curb radiation.
Sure.
According to the nuclear regulator, TEPCO must indicate specific deadlines for the reduction of radiation exposure in the area of the plant under 1 millisievert.
Done.
Oh, you're just indicating that, right?
Right. It's that easy. If If I had fingers, I'd snap them.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission says it will meet with officials of Wolf Creek Nuclear Plant in Kansas to discuss safety-conscious work environment concerns. The meeting stems from a letter the NRC sent last August to officials at the plant saying that a chilled work environment exists within the plant's quality assurance group. The language is just really running away now. A chilled work environment exists within the plant quality assurance group. This is based on a Wolf Creek contractor, Enercon, firing a worker for raising concerns with how work was being performed at the plant.
I find this a chilled work environment.
Well, we'll turn up the heat. Dateline Plymouth, Mass., the owner of the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant, has told the federal NRC that radioactive tritium has been discovered in a newly installed groundwater monitoring well at the plant.
Tritium can't hurt you.
Sample taken from the well indicated a tritium concentration of 69,000 picocuries per liter. Those levels dropped later, actually in early January. The tritium limit for groundwater, according to the EPA, is 20,000 picocuries. However, the groundwater at the Pilgrim site is not used for drinking.
Not anymore.
A nuclear waste shipment on the way from... No, sorry. I'll start where the story starts. The British government stands accused of drafting the consultation process to select the site of a multi-billion dollar nuclear waste storage facility to favor a location that some geologists claim is unsuitable for burying radioactive material. Two leading geologists have told the Observer newspaper they believe the government was eager to push through Sellafield as the site of the facility, a subterranean tunnel network, despite an official inquiry demonstrating that its geology is highly fractured and unsuitable for the safe storage of nuclear waste over a period of time that will probably need 100,000 to a million years to be safe.
Easy. If I had fingers, I'd snap them.
The amount of radioactive substances in groundwater samples collected from an observation well at Fouque is increasing, says TEPCO. TEPCO detected 2.4 million becquerels of stridium-90 and other materials emitting beta particles per liter of groundwater. That's the highest level yet. They don't say officials think the increase was caused by a fresh leak of toxic water. Radioactive materials detected in groundwater from the well have been increasing since autumn.
So it's a trend.
And for 8 months, a federal contractor at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation failed to check some single-shelled radioactive waste tanks for the buildup of hydrogen gas. The federal contractor says some of the radioactive tanks should have been checked as far back as last March and weren't. The tanks were checked in late December. No gas buildups were found.
All clear.
Clean, cheap, safe, too clean to meet him. Your friend, Adam. See you, Eddie.
See you.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the secret stuff. We had a speech this week from President Obama on the subject of the NSA stuff. A speech that, yeah, sure, it would have happened if Edward Snowden hadn't done the thing. We have Mike Rogers, the head of the House Intelligence Committee, going on all over Sunday morning television in America today, dropping hints that Edward Snowden had help from the Russians in stealing in leaking the material from the NSA without providing any evidence. But just, you know, raising the question, just asking. Rogers was there on the shows, basically, aside from that little task, to defend the programs that Obama said in his speech. Need a little tinkering, need a little tweaking. Noticeably, nowhere in his defense of the programs did House Intelligence Chairman Rogers mention the Constitution. Meanwhile, the Guardian newspaper in London reported this week that the NSA has made extensive use of its text message database to extract information on people under no suspicion of illegal activity. It's collected almost 200 million text messages a day from around the world, using them to extract data, including location, contact networks, and credit card details, according to top secret documents. The untargeted collection and storage of SMS messages was revealed in an investigation by The Guardian and UK Channel 4. The documents reveal the UK spy agency has made use of the NSA database to search the metadata of untargeted and unwarranted communications belonging to civilians in the UK. The NSA program, codenamed Dishfire, collects pretty much everything it can, rather than merely storing the communications of existing targets. Travel plans, contact books, financial transactions, and more. The NSA has kept these text messages in their database, including of individuals under no suspicion of illegal activity. The president, in his address on Friday, said something he said before, that there is no evidence that the NSA's metadata collection, bulk collection program of collecting bulk metadata of Americans' telephone calls, untargeted, innocent Americans' telephone calls, no evidence that they have been intentionally abused, those programs. Yet, thanks to the Freedom of Information Act lawsuits by the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the ACLU, we know that the FISA court, which is supposed to provide oversight of these programs, has found otherwise. One of the opinions from 2009 deals directly with the phone metadata surveillance program. The FISA court concluded 5 years after the program was made legal by law, that is to say, not just run by the Bush administration, the FISA court concluded the program had been, quote, so frequently and systematically violated, it can fairly be said that this critical element of the overall regime has never functioned effectively, unquote. In another recently released FISA court opinion about the NSA collection of American internet data, the court accused the NSA of engaging, quote, in systemic overcollection, unquote, for years, and, quote, virtually every metadata record generated by this program included some data that had not been authorized for collection. The judge listed the government's, quote, frequent failures to comply with the terms of the program, excoriated them for their, quote, apparent widespread disregard of FISA court-imposed restrictions, and accused the NSA of committing, quote, longstanding and pervasive violations of the prior orders in this matter, unquote. Never abused. The Wall Street Journal reported the NSA analyst spied on former spouses or lovers. Common enough practice to garner its own spycraft label, Loveint. These scandals not mentioned when officials discuss whether abuse has happened, possibly because, like many other words, the NSA has a different definition of abuse than many, said Director of National Intelligence General Counsel Robert Litt. I'm using abuse in a slightly more limited term, unquote. The program is being reviewed. The president asked a panel to review the program. The panel reported. Now the president is having the panel's report reviewed. And one of the people reviewing it for ways to perhaps turn the collection of metadata over to a third party. Hey, I've got a couple of drives. I'll take them. Is the Director of National Intelligence, the DNI, James Lyer, who is accused of clapping to Congress. Excuse me, James Clapper, who is accused of lying to Congress. Anyway, never abused. If it ain't quite true, might as well set it to music.
Bill, can you trust a report from a secret court? Who even knows where it's been? It's one hell of a kludge when a secret judge denounces a secret sin. You know, I'm the boss of my secret sauce, and your secrets are safe with me. And out of all we collect, the amount we inspect is a coffee cup spilled in the sea. So I get it that you're confused, that you're afraid, your rights have been bruised. But may I call your attention to our strong intention that these powers are never abused. You know, you've probably heard that we use special words that have to be specially defined. So when I say collect, you might fairly expect that I've got something bigger in mind. But when folks ask for proof that our spooks never goof, that big data keeps us secure, just never forget, we don't unclassify yet. Faith's the sure way to be sure. I know you may not be amused by the things that we've done while you snoozed, but may I ask your permission to repeat my position? These powers were never abused. You know, in a decade or five, if they're all still alive, you may learn what really went on. Some will get mad. Others be sad. From this house, I'll be gone. Maybe you overheard a discouraging word, and your skies were cloudy all day. But take it from me, it kept you free to believe every word I say. And if in time I'm excused for the acts over which I enthused, don't let them scold you. Just forget I told you that the powers were never abused.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
Oxford University has apologized after an administrator accidentally emailed a list of all the poorly performing students' marks to their fellow students this week. The email disclosed the names of students who were graded marks 2.2 and below in their first term exams. Dr. Ann Nolan, a senior tutor, said, "We would like to apologize to all the students affected by the disclosure for any distress this has caused." That's nice. Jordan Belfort, portrayed by Leonardo DiCaprio in The Wolf of Wall Street, says prosecutors in Brooklyn have apologized to him for erroneous information that appeared in a Wall Street Journal article on his alleged avoidance of restitution payments. I thought restitution was... Belfort's lawyer says Belfort has promised to give 100% of the royalties to his fraud victims and has made every mandated restitution payment. He says the U.S. Attorney's Office personally apologized through his lawyer for the misinformation. Air Canada has apologized to an Alberta soldier with post-traumatic stress disorder whose dog was banned from a flight because the company said it was not a service animal. Sergeant Shirley Jew said the airline told her PTSD isn't recognized as a disability that requires a service dog. They've apologized. The E! Channel has apologized for a graphic that was posted on their live internet coverage of the Golden Globes. The graphic described Michael J. Fox's 1991 diagnosis with Parkinson's disease as a fun fact. So the network, we regret the insensitive classification. We understand the serious nature of the disease and sincerely apologize. Neiman Marcus apologized for the recent hack that resulted in stolen customer credit card data. Madonna apologized for using a racial slur on Instagram to refer to her white son a day after calling those who criticized her language haters. She quickly deleted the comment after Instagram users berated her for the use of the N-word, though she was initially defiant. Quote, I am sorry if I offended anyone with my use of the N-word. It was not meant as a racial slur. I am not a racist. It was all about intention. It was used as a term of endearment toward my son, who is white. I apologize if I gave the people the wrong impression. But please mention my name some more. The daughter of a top Chinese Communist Party official has apologized over the killing of one of her teachers. She's the latest Red Guard, former Red Guard, to express remorse for the horrors of the Cultural Revolution, according to Chinese state media. Song Binbin's father, Song Renquang, was a powerful general, and she herself was a leader of the Red Guards at her school as a teenager. Wouldn't we all want to kill our teachers sometimes? And vice versa. Speaking as somebody who's been both. Fitbit, the company makes wearable activity trackers, has apologized following widespread reports that its latest wrist-worn device has caused severe skin irritation for some owners. And the creators of How I Met Your Mother have apologized for a recent episode which had what many viewers were offended and described, by which many viewers were offended and described as racist imagery. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, it is a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at this same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America by the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 megahertz shortwave, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world by the internet at two different locations, live and archive whenever you want at harryshearer.com and kcsn.org. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available as a free podcast through WWNO.org, iTunes, SoundCloud, and Sideshow Network. And be just like taking money from cola companies while advising the government on limiting sugar, if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much. Tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, and get well soon to Pam Halstead. And thanks to Adrian, what's your last name?
Bonham. Yeah, I knew that.
Here at Global Radio in London for help with today's podcast. And thanks, as always, to Jenny Lawson in New Orleans. Hey, in case I forgot to mention it, and I did until now, Cars That Talk t-shirts for the first time available at the harryshearer.com store, just $5. Cars I Talk t-shirts. Wow. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO, New Orleans, Louisiana, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from London.